9:30. Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson sitting in for Joy Cardine. Well, there is a lot of discussion about climate change and so forth, and once in a while we can see what we think might be results of that. We don't really know. If you live along the Great Lakes, you may notice that there's a lot more shoreline than there used to be. Beaches go out further into the water, or where the water used to be. Water levels are low. Lake Superior has had a drastic water level change just in the past couple of years, and if it drops 3 more inches, which it's likely to do by fall, it will set a record. Water temperatures also in Lake Superior, which is traditionally a very cold lake, measured at 75 degrees at the surface, which is also very unusual for this time of the year. What does all this mean, if anything? What's happening to lake levels? And it's not just the Great Lakes. Inland lakes in northern and central Wisconsin are drying up. Many of them are spring-fed, and some are just disappearing. Boats can't get to docks. Tourism is affected. The ships carrying cargo into the Great Lakes can't carry as much because there's not as much water, and so they have to come in lighter and leave lighter. So this is also having an economic impact there. We're going to talk about this topic in general this hour and find out maybe what's behind it, if there is anything that you can do about it, or if this is just part of some sort of weather cycle that we're in, perhaps related to El Nino or something like that. We're going to explore all of these topics this hour, and you can join us. Here are the phone numbers, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number. If you're in Madison, please call us at 263-1890, 263-1890. My guest by telephone this hour is Jay Austin, Assistant Professor of Physics at the Large Lakes Observatory at the University of Minnesota, Duluth. Good morning, Professor Austin. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me.
So the Lake Superior is down, what, 18 inches almost and perhaps more?
Give or take, yeah, that's about right.
Living in Superior as I do and traveling a lot around the south shore of Lake Superior, you can really see. You go over to Ashland, Washburn, the Schwamigan Bay Area, and holy smokes, it's just not the same lake.
Yeah, it's the low lake stands that we're seeing right now really are largely a factor or a result of the drought that we're in the midst of right now. Sort of the last 12 months or so, rainfall has been very low, or precipitation has been very low. That's really what's driving what we're seeing right now.
Well, we've really, in some respects, we've had a drought for the past couple of years, and it's been a number of winters since we had an awful lot of snow, the kind of snow that many of us grew up remembering in this part of the country. And there have been a number of winters recently also where the lake hasn't frozen over completely. Isn't that true?
Sure. There's certainly a lot of variability from year to year in how the lake responds to the climate. What we're seeing right now, this drop over the last 12 months or so, is on top of sort of a long-term trend since the mid-80s towards lower water levels. So the lake was already pretty low when this drought started. I think that's one of the reasons we're seeing these record low stands.
Now, just prior to this, it seemed like we were in a period where lake levels were abnormally high. I still recall people complaining about there being too much water in Lake Superior, and we ought to let some of it go away. Does this suggest to you that this is part of some sort of climate cycle, or is there something else at work here?
It's really hard to tell. First of all, I'll have to say that I'm relatively new to the lake, so I don't have a good anecdotal memory of what happened here 20 years ago. We just moved up here about 2 years ago, and both actually my wife and I are studying issues associated with the Great Lakes. But the Great Lakes were at record highs in the early 1980s. Lake level, or water level in general, is a relatively easy thing to measure. And the other thing is it's very important to measure. It's very important for commerce. So we have records in Duluth, for instance, going back to 1860. And at a couple other locations around Lake Superior and the Great Lakes. And the all-time high levels were in the late 70s and early 80s. So I think a lot of it is that what we're comparing it to right now is these you know, record highs within the last 25 years. But the last 25 years have been sort of this steady decline.
Now, just to kind of refresh people's memory, of course, none of us are old enough to remember when the Great Lakes were formed, but how did Lake Superior come to be?
Oh, I think you want to get a geologist on the phone for something like that. I'll start off our conversation by saying my focus is really on how Lake Superior responds to climate change. And there are plenty of people who could give you a better answer regarding formation or fish or other topics like that are certainly related and interesting. I don't want to stick my foot in it early on here, though.
Okay, well, let's just say the glaciers caused it, and we'll leave it at that. We're at weather time. We'll find out if the drought continues or maybe if somebody's going to get a little rain around the state of Wisconsin. We'll check that, and then we'll come back, and we'll take your phone calls. What do you think about this situation, and what has been your experience? Maybe you live on a lake, Lake Superior, Lake Michigan. Maybe you live on one of our inland lakes and have something to share about water levels. 800-642-1234 is the toll-free number, 263-1890 if you're in Madison. John Munson sitting in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 17 and a half minutes past 7 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about water levels in Lake Superior and how that's related to the climate, what that means economically, and how that might affect all of us, wherever we live, even if it's not next to the greatest of the Great Lakes. And my guest on the telephone this morning is Jay Austin. He's assistant professor of physics at the Large Lakes Observatory, located at the University of Minnesota, Duluth. You can join our discussion, and we do have phone lines available for you by calling 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. In Madison, please use 263-1890, 263-1890. And if you would like to send us an email, you can do that as well. Here's our address, talk@wpr.org. Professor Austin, tell us a little bit about the Large Lakes Observatory. What exactly are you doing there?
Sure. There's a group of scientists here at the University of Minnesota Duluth who all have specific interests in the sort of fundamental science behind how lakes work. There are a lot of lake research institutes around the United States or around the world. The majority of them are focused on management of lakes or the restoration of lakes, things like that. Large Lakes Observatory is one of the few places that really focuses on sort of fundamental science as opposed to these more applied topics. So we have several people who do geology. There's a big focus on looking at sediment cores in lakes and trying to determine what those tell us about the past climate over the last 10,000 or 100,000 years. We have chemists who look at how chemicals move through the chemical makeup of lakes. I'm the local physicist looking at how wind moves water around or looking at how the lake responds to climate over long periods of time. So it's a really interesting group. We also operate a research vessel, the Blue Heron, which leaves out of Duluth that you may see out there every now and then. It's a very active, very interesting group. We actually have three new people coming, and we have two biologists coming in the fall and another physicist. So we have a nice group here.
Now, according to some of the material that I read preparing for this, the surface temperature of the water in Lake Superior right now is 75 degrees. Is that an average, or is that just in some of the warm spots?
Well, that number has been bubbling around, and unfortunately, that is a number from last season. That was the high temperature that we had last season, which was 2 or 3 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the previous record high temperature. So it was a remarkable number in the sense that it was so much greater than what we've seen in the past. the work that I've been doing regarding lake temperature is looking at long-term trends in average summer temperatures. And what we found is that the lake is warming up much more quickly than sort of regional atmosphere. So our sort of first-order guess was that if the atmosphere warmed up by a degree, we would expect the lake surface temperatures to warm up by a degree. What we found when we did this work using data from buoys out in the middle of the lake was that if the atmosphere heats up a degree, the lake heats up 2 degrees. And we spent a lot of time puzzling over what was causing this discrepancy. And what we're finding is that in addition to the fact that we're having warmer summers now, we're having milder winters, we're getting less ice cover, as you mentioned earlier, and when you reduce the amount of ice cover, you end up essentially allowing the summer season to start a little bit earlier. And if the summer season starts earlier, the lake simply has more time to warm up to try to catch up with the atmosphere. So most of the variability we see from year to year in summer temperatures has to do with how much, doesn't have to do with how warm or cold of a summer you're having. It has to do with how mild or how harsh the previous winter was. So if you have a very harsh winter, summer starts very late, you have a cool lake that season. If you have a very mild winter, like we're having more and more of, you end up with an early start to the summer season and much warmer lake.
I was just going to ask, if the lake is warmer to begin with going into the winter season, it would take longer then for the lake water temperature to get low enough to form ice then too, wouldn't it?
That's a really good point, and something that we're starting to look at is that next step of the feedback, going for how does the summer affect the subsequent winter. And we have not been able to show that there's much of a link there. And we have some ideas about why that may be. But what we're doing right now is starting to run what are called numerical models. And you've heard a bunch about numerical models with this bridge collapse. They're going to use numerical models to try to figure out why the 35 West bridge collapsed. You can put a pretend bridge inside a computer and play with it and see what happens and see if you can recreate that disaster. We can do the same thing with a lake or any body of water. We can build a model inside a computer that tells us about how the lake responds to various atmospheric conditions. So what we're doing right now is building these models and running them through a giant assortment of scenarios to see how they respond to various aspects of climate change. And hopefully we'll be able to comment more authoritatively, I guess, on whether summer conditions really do impact what goes on the subsequent winter.
What's the relationship between lake temperature and evaporation? And do you get more evaporation in the wintertime when there's a greater contrast between the lake, which is above freezing if it hasn't frozen over, and the air temperature? Or how does that work?
Right. That's exactly right. And it's actually counter to what most people sort of guess intuitively. Evaporation rates are actually much greater in the winter, as you just said. And it has everything to do with the fact that you have 0 degree water, 32 degree Fahrenheit water at the surface, and you have, minus 10 degree air blowing down out of Alberta or something like that. And that very cold, extremely dry air is very, very effective at evaporating the water from the lake surface. The other interesting thing we think is going on, and we think is tied into this long-term decline in water levels, getting back to water levels now, is that the more ice you have on the lake, the harder it is to evaporate water. Essentially, ice acts as a cap, a protective cap on the surface. And if you suddenly have lots of open water, if you don't form a lot of ice in one season, you simply have a lot more surface area to evaporate. A second thing that's going on is as water temperatures go up, faster than air temperatures, that can lead to increased evaporation rates as well.
Let me give the phone numbers again. We have some open lines, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number, 263-1890 if you're in Madison. Let's challenge our listeners. Ask them a question. What has your experience of lake levels been? There have been lots of accounts in newspapers and stories on television and radio about people not being able to get their boats up to their docks, not being able to run their boats into places where they've always been able to go, and navigation issues on inland lakes as well as on Lake Superior. What's been your experience? Call and let us. Let us know what's been going on in your neck of the woods as we face these lower water levels. Lake Superior is certainly the dominant feature of the climate for people who live around it, just as people who live around Lake Michigan have their climate dominated by the lake as well. When that water evaporates from the lake, it goes someplace. Does it end up as snow in the UP, or does it just disappear?
I have read some reports that lake effect snow on the UP has increased over the last several decades. So that may be tied into these greater evaporation rates.
So the cold, dry air comes in from wherever it comes, Alberta and various other places, and it picks up that water. If it doesn't drop it as snow, where does it go?
It stays in the atmosphere in that case. Or is dropped as precipitation further downstream. It really just depends.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I'm all set.
Okay. All right. Let's take a quick call before news time, and we'll welcome John in Duluth. John, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Morning. Thanks for taking my call. I did some research last summer on the Apostle Islands with a grad student from UMD and a professor from Northland College. And we were on York Island during the big storms and whatnot, just watched everything getting churned up. And I was wondering, the next morning after all the storms and everything were done, we noticed a line of fish eggs just all along the beach. And I thought it was pretty remarkable, just how the storm and everything turned them up. But I had a question as far as how that impacts, as far as you were saying, sorry, I guess the physicist, saying how he deals with the wind and how that moves the water, and as far as the water level dropping and what sort of impact that has, I guess, on the ecological sustainability, I guess, as far as wrecking, plants and fish and that sort of thing, if that has a huge impact or if that's just more of just the storm aspect.
We have about 40 seconds until we have to break for news here, so we can get a short answer to that and then come back to it afterwards if we want.
There's a host of things to address there. I think that the big question that people are asking right now is if the lake temperatures are going up as quickly as they appear to be, what are going to be the impacts on the ecosystem? And it is an extremely difficult question just because there are so many aspects of an ecosystem that depend strongly on temperature. It's not clear what the overall result will be when all of those aspects, all of those reaction rates and metabolisms and things like that all start changing at the same time.
So, well, let's come back to that and look at it in more detail after we take a break for the news. I don't want to rush this through because this is a really important question, and you'll have a few minutes to compose another answer. 800-642-1234, the number to call to join our conversation about water levels in the Great Lakes. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine this week, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. It's 7:35. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson sitting in for Joy Cardine this week on the Ideas Network. And this hour we're talking about water levels in Lake Superior, water levels in lakes all across Wisconsin. Wisconsin has somewhere in the neighborhood of 15,000 lakes. Most of them are spring-fed and have no natural inlets. They're not necessarily the product of a river or a stream of any kind, and these lakes are drying up. Some seem to be almost disappearing. Water tables are dropping. People's wells are going dry. There are all sorts of impacts of this. Rain or precipitation levels have been abnormally low for the last several years, and this is causing a number of problems. Our guest is Jay Austin, who is Assistant Professor of Physics at the Large Lakes Observatory, which is located at the University of Minnesota, Duluth. And, of course, that's situated right at the western end of the greatest of the Great Lakes, Lake Superior. Just before the news break, Professor Austin, you were starting to talk about how the effect of wind and so forth and climate on the lake is affecting the ecosystem of the lake and surrounding areas. If you'd like to continue to expand on that, that would be just fine with me.
Sure. I think the thing that's worth keeping in mind about these changes in water level and water temperature is that the lake itself is not going to be a fundamentally different place if it's a foot or 2 feet lower. How the lake interacts with the coastline and stuff like that, the distribution of wetlands, things like that will change a little bit, but the lake as a whole, the biology, the chemistry of the lake is going to be exactly the same as before. As the temperature increases, however, that really is going to fundamentally change the makeup of the ecosystem of the lake. You're going to see a different distribution of species. You're going to see species that were not comfortable in the lake suddenly being comfortable in the lake in some sense. Other ones that have particular temperature ranges that they like to spawn in are going to be in smaller concentrations. So the temperature, if you live in the lake, you care about the temperature. If you live around the lake, like us, if your commerce depends on it, then you're going to care about water level.
So does this mean, for example, that if the water is warmer, there is more opportunity for certain types of plants or algae, that kind of thing, to come in that haven't been a big issue in Lake Superior because of the coldness of the water?
It sort of goes both ways. There's some species that are going to find it more hospitable and some species that will find it less hospitable. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of fish species have very specific temperature ranges in which they like to spawn. So if you suddenly have a lake that's 5 degrees warmer, then some fish are going to find that just fine and other ones are not going to like it at all. Or it's going to change their distribution. You'll find them suddenly in the eastern part of the lake where it tends to be cooler than in the western part.
Let's go next to Bill in Ettrick. Bill, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Good morning for having me. I was wondering, I once heard it said that all the water that's on Earth, that's ever been on Earth, is still here. It just keeps getting recycled. And I was wondering, if the lake levels are lowering, eventually won't they come back? If this is true about, like, if you drink a glass of water, you may sweat it all out. It's just getting recycled. Is that true? I don't know. I've heard it said that. So eventually, would the lake levels eventually come back if all the water, it's just moving around, like it evaporates, it might go somewhere else and rain down somewhere?
Sure. The water is not being taken out of existence. Your statement about there being roughly the same amount of water is approximately correct. You could come up with a couple of fairly minor exceptions to that rule. But, yeah, Lake Superior could get lower. The trick is the amount of water that Lake Superior will lose in the process of getting lower is very small compared to the total amount of water on Earth. So, you know, Lake Superior could go down by a foot, but the oceans would go up by a millimeter or something like that.
Okay.
So we're talking about relatively small amounts of water in the global water budget.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Appreciate you joining us this morning. Lake Superior still has a heck of a lot of water in it. It's not like it's going away.
Sure. Oh, that's right. You know, it's dropping a foot when you're a lake that, I don't remember the average depth off the top of my head, but it's on the order of 500 feet deep. So, you know, dropping 1 foot really makes very little difference to the lake as a whole.
But it does make a lot of difference to the shoreline, as you pointed out, and as somebody who's driven around it, it really looks different. It's a real stark contrast, particularly in the Shawamigan Bay, which is the part of the lake that I see the most often. There are also some concerns about the wild rice beds along the lake and some things like that that are going to be adversely affected by lower lake levels.
Right. I was just down the Apostle Islands, and you look at the boat docks down there. And the floating docks are all extremely steep right now, trying to get down to the water. And the ones that aren't floating are so far above that it's actually difficult to get into boats right now. Everything is built with this assumption that water levels are going to stay roughly the same. And when you have a dramatic drop like this, it it really does make a big difference. Right down in the Apostle Islands right now, they're putting up fences along the edges of docks just because the drop-off is so steep from these on floating docks. And then, like you said in your intro, when you drop water by a foot, suddenly you have to light load ships coming in and out of Duluth. The channels are dredged to particular depths, and I think it's for every inch of water that you lose, you have to put roughly 250 tons less cargo in. So if you are down 12 inches, that's 4 tons or 3 tons of cargo. 3,000 tons of cargo that you have to leave behind and have to come back again and get. At the locks in Sault Ste. Marie right now, they have a power generation plant there that runs the locks. And because they're cutting down the amount of water, the Army Corps of Engineers has some control over the amount of water that leaves Lake Superior and goes into Michigan Huron. And they've cut that back as far as they can at this stage. And it means they're generating less power, and they have to buy power from the grid, essentially, to run the locks now.
Let's take a quick call before weather time. We'll go next to Fred in Adams County. Fred, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. I work in Forest Fire Tower for 12 years. I was up last July. Normally, you're never up in a fire tower in the summer. The last two springs, including this one, I can smell that forest fire burning up in the boundary waters. Up in a fire tower, you can smell the smoke. And I live 20 miles south of Wisconsin Rapids. So this is carrying a long way. So there's an insatiable demand for water all over. But upper end of Rush Creek, my favorite trout stream in Adams County, went dry last year. It's going dry this year. Now, another quick comment. Is it true that the ethanol plants, a medium size, and there's 121 in the United States, use an equivalent of 10,000 homes, a city of 10,000 people? It sounds like they're taking a lot of our water, too. There's no end to this demand for our water. And I'll take your comments off the air.
All right. Thank you very much, Fred. A lot to chew on there. I don't know how much of that you can really comment on, but give it a shot.
Well, I'm obviously not an expert on ethanol production, but he's absolutely right that as we move to these different sources of fuel, we just introduce ourselves to a different set of problems. Ethanol is particularly interesting in that it actually takes between 3/4 and 1 gallon of fuel to produce 1 gallon of ethanol. So you really aren't gaining very much. And yes, it is an enormous, it uses enormous amounts of water. Not to put too political of a spin on this, but if I was concerned about water levels, I would not be worrying about climate change. I would be worrying about Texas, Oklahoma, people outside the watershed. Because as these major agricultural areas south of us, outside our watershed, become more and more dry as aquifers down there dry up, as they have done over the last several decades, these gigantic lakes full of fresh water can become more and more appealing down there, and political will to keep the lake water in the lake is going to weaken on a federal level.
We're at weather time. We'll take a check of weather around the state of Wisconsin, and we'll come back and we'll talk more about water levels in lakes and streams and all that stuff and how it's affecting people. You can join our discussion. 800-642-1234 is the toll-free number to call. 263-1890, please, if you're in Madison. You can also reach us on the internet. Send us an email, talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 7:47. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine this week on the Ideas Network. Well, after three today on Here on Earth, Gene Faraca talks with poet and scholar Kwame Dawes about the influence of African arts and culture on America. That's after 3 o'clock this afternoon on Here on Earth, here on Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour we're talking about water, water in the Great Lakes, water where you live. And our guest is Jay Austin, Assistant Professor of Physics at the Large Lakes Observatory at the University of Minnesota Duluth. There's a term that one of our listeners emailed in and wanted explained that you used, and that is the term watershed. What is a watershed?
Watershed just refers to the area where if rain falls into the watershed, it ends up in the lake. So the watershed for Lake Superior is just a region around Lake Superior that feeds water into Lake Superior. And the interesting thing about Lake Superior compared to most other lakes is that its watershed is relatively small. In other words, most of the water that enters Lake Superior actually falls directly onto the surface of Lake Superior. The surrounding land that feeds into Lake Superior is about half of the size of Lake Superior itself. So and usually what happens is a lake has a watershed many, many times its size.
So the water that's in Lake Superior was largely the water that was there when the glaciers moved back and left it all behind. Is that
more to the point, water that is in Lake Superior is rain that fell directly onto Lake Superior as opposed to falling on the land and moving through streams and such into Lake Superior.
Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Irene in Monona. Irene, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Your guest, thank you for the program, by the way. It is a big concern nationally for us as well as globally. But one of our major concerns has been for the situation in the United States. And he just mentioned, if you're concerned, be concerned about Texas. And it just brought to mind, we heard an author that came to town a couple of years ago, wrote an excellent book, Robert Glennon, and the name is Water Follies. I don't know if the guest is familiar with the book, but the whole concept of the book was explaining why we should be concerned with the state or the use of water, similar to what he was just explaining nationally, and why our water is going to start looking very attractive to the Southwest. And he really just gets into water in general, spring water, why we should be concerned about, you know, obviously using it and things like that. So I just wanted to mention it because it was very pertinent when he said brought up the Southwest.
Well, thanks for the call.
Well, you're very welcome, and thank you for the program.
Well, you're welcome, too. This is an issue that's been discussed in, over the years, diverting water from Lake Superior to satisfy drier areas elsewhere where they need irrigation to grow things. There has been a Great Lakes Compact that's been discussed. I don't know if everybody has signed on to it or not. A Great Lakes Water Compact that would describe how the lake water can be used. Are you aware of that, and could you speak to that for a little bit?
I'm not really that familiar with the politics of water, and I obviously didn't mean to pick on Texas specifically earlier, but the caller got the point, is that the Southwest and the central of the United States, as they are more and more pressed for water, are going to look north and see these Great Lakes up there, and they've been seeing them for a long time. Right now we have an international commission, the International Joint Commission with Canada, that controls the flow of water through the lakes, and so they're the ones who determine how much water leaves through the Sioux or how much water leaves through the Welland Canal between Erie and Ontario, other things like that. But I am not as spun up on more recent politics. I know that the Great Lakes states certainly have an agreement to keep water within the catchment basin of the Great Lakes. Catchment basin is roughly the same thing as a watershed.
And there is no secret pipeline that's taking the water from Lake Superior and transporting it to Las Vegas, for example.
You know, I've heard that several times recently, and the scale of engineering that would be required to move the amount of water out of Lake Superior that would cause the drops that we've seen is just unimaginable. It would be very difficult to do something like that in secret. So I think that most of what we are seeing right now, is understandable in terms of reduction in ice cover in the winter and warmer water temperatures in the summer and other fairly mundane sorts of things.
We have some callers waiting to join us, so let's go back to the phones and we'll take some comments from Tom, who's on the road. Tom, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, good morning, Professor. My question revolves around the additional water that's added to the watershed for the Great Lakes. And where does it originate from in bulk? Is it, like, carried on the Gulf Stream from the Gulf of Mexico, jet stream from the Gulf of Mexico, or from the Arctic Circle? Because a lot of the lake effect snow that falls on the Upper Peninsula, for example, where I have some property, is essentially lake effect. It originates in the lake itself, and so it doesn't add to the total lake levels, even as precipitation. So where do those rainfall patterns come from originally, the additional water, and why are they being disrupted?
I see. Again, I feel like every question everybody's asked me so far has been me dodging and suggesting that I'm not an expert in that. The trick is there are so many scientific aspects to how these things work, it's very difficult to be spun up on all of them at the same time. You're right. These weather patterns are coming, you know, out of the Arctic or typically out of the Arctic and dumping water from outside the watershed as precipitation into the Great Lakes. There is one diversion in the northern part of Lake Superior that diverts water from outside the watershed into Lake Superior through the Ogaki Canal or the Ogaki diversion. I don't remember the exact name. But most of the water that ends up in the Great Lakes, new water, is coming from weather systems outside the watershed.
And some of it may be coming from the Pacific or from the Gulf of Mexico, depending on which way the wind happens to be blowing.
Sure, sure. Yes.
Let's go next to Jessica in Green Bay. Jessica, good morning.
Good morning. I actually don't have a question. I just wanted to call in with a comment about the Great Lakes Compact, sort of to answer where it is politically. In December of 2005, the 8 Great Lakes governors signed the Great Lakes Compact, which, like you said, does deal with water diversions. But where it's at now is that every state legislature needs to pass the Great Lakes Compact. And while no state can go below the baseline that the compact set, they can go above and beyond that, which is actually a good thing because there are some loopholes in the compact, as you would get anytime 8 different states have to agree on one thing. One of the things that I'm particularly concerned about is the bottled water loophole that's in that. And I don't know if your guest knows anything about that at all, but I think it's a pretty important issue. The only other state that's passed the compact through their legislature right now is Minnesota. It looks like Illinois is going to be doing that. It's sitting on their governor's desk. But Wisconsin's actually pretty far behind because we haven't even introduced the legislation yet.
What's the bottled water loophole?
Basically, it says that if the compact says we don't want states building a pipeline and shipping water out of the Great Lakes and out of the watershed, but if you put it in a container that's 5.7 gallons or less, then it's okay with us. So basically, it allows multinational corporations to divert the water as long as they put it in a bottle.
Well, thanks for that. Our callers are informative and educated, and it's what makes this network go. Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Lee in Shawano. Lee, good afternoon.
Yes.
Good morning. You're on the air.
I know. Yeah, it's funny. You could get confused very easily. Yes. Hi, John, and hi, Professor Austin. I just wanted to make a brief comment. I take a daily walk all the time. I'm calling you from Shawano, Wisconsin, and it's just really heartbreaking. All the little ponds, all the little creeks, I mean, they are completely dried out. It's just... you just can't believe what you're seeing and experiencing. That's all I really wanted to say.
Well, thanks for the call. That is a huge problem in northern and central Wisconsin right now because of the drought we're in, is that all lake levels and stream levels are way down. You can tell by driving or if you're using a boat on the lakes. It's not just Lake Superior. Everywhere it's dried up. Professor, we in the last few minutes of the program, perhaps we can talk about what can be done. I mean, is this something that, okay, if everybody goes out and buys a hybrid vehicle or does this or that, can we actually have any impact on the lake level?
I think that the impact of those sorts of things is very indirect in some sense. I think really the best thing that people can be doing right now is being educated and understanding what's going on in the Great Lakes. The the ability to change what we're doing to the climate is not going to come from individuals. It really has to be something done on a multinational level, and it's going to take an enormous amount of political will. It's not clear to me at this stage, and it's sort of a personal comment, it's not clear to me where that sort of political will, the ability to make those sorts of uncomfortable choices is going to come from. But really, I think what we can do right now is sit around and hope that it's going to rain soon. That is really the thing that's going on right now. The fact that, like your last caller said, little streams and ponds are dried up, but also the big lakes are responding, is simply a function of the drought that we've had for the last 12 months.
Well, I know everybody around here is consistently imploring for more rain, and maybe that'll be the solution to it. Thank you very much, Professor Austin, for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me on.
Professor Jay Austin is Assistant Professor of Physics at the Large Lakes Observatory, located at the University of Minnesota, Duluth. This program was produced by Karen Prager, who also did the on-air production, along with Cheryl Gasser. And if you would like a copy of the program, you can call the radio store, 800-747-7444, and ask for program 88B, as in boy. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network.